Alright, we're in Managed Worlds. Lucien Wilshick?
Wishick.
I just can't get people's names right. The audience is aware of that. So, you are essentially the keeper of the cloth for VB.net.
Yep.
And we had you on Channel 9 a while ago. It was me, Eric Meyer, and a gentleman from MSR. We were talking about
Cloutier Rousset.
Yes. And you had just started pretty much in this role.
Absolutely.
At that point. So it's been a little while since you've... So thanks for coming on. So you guys, Async, what's going on?
Async. Actually, it's interesting you started with Claudio Rosso, you know, because the work we were doing with them was a prototype called Concurrent Basic.
Yes.
That really... It's done from an MSR project a few years ago. We really, or they really, at MSR, identified the problem that concurrency and asynchrony, those are complicated words. What they identified was that writing applications that don't freeze up on you when they're blocked waiting for the network response was a common need, and it was getting a much more common need, and something needed to be done. And Concurrent Basic was their one of the attempts that they produced to try and deal with this. What we did was we ported it into the regular Visual Basic Code. We showed it at TechFest, an internal review. Showed it to Bill Gates and other people.
Nice.
It was a good experiment. We got valuable feedback. Actually, the chief feedback we got from that was people didn't care so much for all of the messages that were flowing around in something. They wanted something that had simpler control flow. The one feature of it that they really loved was the ability to invoke operations on the main thread of the windowed application, of the WinForms or WPF application, because that came from a world where work was happening in a background thread, and everyone needs some way to do work on the foreground thread. It was a good experiment for those results, and I think really what we've come up now with the async CTP is a much better, in fact, the best solution I've seen so far to this problem.
Okay, interesting. Now, just to make it explicit and clear, just because you do something asynchronously doesn't mean it's happening on a background thread. In fact, there doesn't have to be another thread involved at all. So can we make this clear to people?
Absolutely.
Okay.
This is a really subtle point, you know.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be subtle.
I think when I speak with people, 50%, 70% of them think asynchrony means background thread. When you read academic research papers, they say asynchrony involves many threads. That's not at all true. Asynchrony, well, I like languages. Let's think about the etymology of the word asynchrony. A means not. Synchrony means at the same time. Asynchrony just means not at the same time. It means that when you invoke a function, it's going to return a placeholder for you immediately, but the actual computed result of that function will only come into the placeholder at a much later time. This has said absolutely nothing about background threads. I haven't told you anything about which threads it's running on. All I've said is that the result comes asynchronously. It comes out of time with respect to when you called it initially. Now, the placeholder that we're using is called the task type. It already shipped in Visual Studio 2010. A task of T is a placeholder for an object of type T. That's the key message. Now, how do we do asynchrony? One way to do asynchrony is to launch a background thread, which once it's finished, it will give the result back in the placeholder. But that's only one way of doing asynchrony, and often it's not the best way of doing asynchrony. What are other ways of doing asynchrony? Well, I have an example that I really like.
Okay.
Imagine you're at a restaurant, right? A waiter's job is to wait on the patrons at a table. If you want to serve two tables concurrently, you need to hire two waiters. That's not true, is it? You can serve two tables with a single waiter. You don't need to hire two waiters for it. In exactly the same way, if you want to give the illusion of doing two things at once, you don't need to create two threads to do it. You can just have a single thread that switches between the two tasks, like the waiter switches between the two tables.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't new. This already existed back in Windows 3.1 days. They called it yield at that stage. What we've got is, to some extent, rediscovering that, but in a more elegant way, a way that works properly and composes properly with all of the modern language features we've come to expect.
Absolutely.
I want to go back on that. So the key message is that asynchrony does not necessarily mean background threads. And the analogy I drew was with the waiters. You don't need two waiters to serve two tables. I was reading a blog recently. It was the Android developers blog. And they made this similar logical fallacy of thinking that two tables require two waiters. But it's such an easy fallacy to fall into when we talk about parallel computing. The reasoning they said is, when you need to do lots of work, you shouldn't do it on the UI thread, because that will make the UI thread non-responsive. Typical examples are things like network requests, which might take an unpredictable length of time to complete. Mm-hmm. All of those sentences seem so beguilingly true on the surface, but there's a hole in the logic. When your program sends a network request and it's waiting for the result of that network request, it's not doing work. It's not doing any work. It's just standing there completely idle. So the first sentence, it said, when you need to do lots of work, you shouldn't do it on the UI thread. That remains true. But making a network request does not constitute work. It just constitutes sitting around idly. So, the message there is that for the vast bulk of our applications, our business applications or our desktop applications, they're sitting there, they're making a request to a database waiting for the result. They're making a request to a web page or a web service waiting for the result. They're not doing work. They do not benefit from having multiple threads. They can do asynchrony because the result of the web request or the database request will come back at some time later, mm-hmm. but they don't need multiple threads to do it.
Interesting. This is absolutely true. And this is what you guys have implemented. And the interesting thing is the type that you've chosen, or that, I mean, is essentially a requirement, as you mentioned. You called it the stub type in terms of the placeholder, is a task. Which yes. traditionally is used for task-based parallelism.
It's an unfortunate word. That's the price we pay for using the existing type rather than inventing a new type.
Well, it's good that you didn't invent a new type. But let's talk a little bit about, we've covered a lot of this stuff with Mads and also Stephen Tobe from the library and the C-sharp side. You being the VB guy, the VB.net guy, how does this manifest itself in VB.net, and what are some of the consequences that have resulted from this implementation in your language?
Now, I actually had a good starting point. I started by implementing it in C#, and then I implemented it in VB. And what we saw... the exciting thing is this. An asynchronous method is one that does some work. It comes to an await point where it suspends its execution while other work is done elsewhere, and then it resumes its execution. There's something else that C# programmers will be very used to that's very similar. Iterators in C# have exactly the same thing. They're doing some work, they come across this yield return statement, they suspend their work, and later on, when the for each loop continues, then they resume their work. And actually, at a deep level, iterator methods and async methods are actually the same. In Visual Basic, I made them share exactly the same implementation. There's maybe 50 lines difference between the two features. That's an incredible feature. I mean, it gave us a lot of advantage. We could share the same code base for implementation as well as for testing. We could use the vast suite of C# iterator tests to test the async feature as well, because they're actually using the same implementation technique underneath. But on a language design perspective, the fact that these two are the same, gave us the opportunity to introduce async methods and iterator methods in the same breath. And the fact that they're so profoundly similar gave us the opportunity to reflect this similarity in the language syntax and semantics that we chose. So VB, you'll find a lot of regularity and similarity between the async and the iterative features. I'm going to tell you some of those features.
Sure.
I'm going to assume that the audience has already seen iterators in some form in C#.
Yes.
And I know that they have, because every conference I go to, the very first question is, what about iterators in Visual Basic? Okay, this is the answer.
Perfect.
In C# and VB, we decided that an async method is identified by the async modifier on it. So, in VB, we decided that an iterator method is identified by the iterator modifier on it. C# doesn't have this modifier, VB does, just to keep it similar with async. The next thing is, it sounds like a silly syntactical thing, but C# has to use this pair of keywords, yield return and yield break. But because we've already got the iterator modifier, we don't need to play these syntax tricks. VB just uses a single keyword, yield, and a single keyword, return, to exit out of an iterator method in a normal way. Mm. There are some other more in-depth features. Now, in the await case, we were very clear that we had to be able to use an await expression inside a try block that has a catch handler at the end. It's needed in all of the samples we've written, and it's just a basic requirement. So we allowed yield statements inside try blocks that have catch outside them. This doesn't happen in C#. The reason it didn't happen in C# is actually quite convoluted. The implementation technique that C# was using was very different, and it didn't stretch to this.
Interesting.
The other difference is that with async, we were very clear that we wanted async anonymous methods or async lambdas. There are a lot of very good reasons for this. For instance, when you do want to run stuff on a background thread, mm-hmm. note that you don't have to, note that this is only good for CPU-bound work, but when you do want to, you will very often pass an async lambda to the task.run method. Therefore, we have to support async lambdas. Therefore, VB supports iterator lambdas as well, just by similarity.
Excellent.
It's actually a really interesting... the language itself has as a consequence of adding this async, you've actually moved VB closer, in some sense, to C#. We had the conversation about a year ago regarding the co-evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a great example of how the language are co-evolving. You didn't just add async to both languages. In order to get async into both languages, you had to modify and evolve one of the languages so that you could implement it in the same way using iterators, which makes perfect sense. So now VB people get iterators.
Absolutely.
They should be happy.
They will be happy.
Right on. So congratulations to the VB.net people and good work there. So let's talk a little bit about... the implementation details.
Mm-hmm.
So we've thrown out in the conversation we've had so far with Stephen Chobe and Mads, and of course we'll be talking to Anders as well. But with you, I'd like to talk about how exactly do iterators? I mean, we can say that iterators are involved or the similar mechanisms that enable iterators to exist in the first place is really what you're using. Talk to me about what that is. So, what is it about iterators and the thing and the stuff that makes them possible that was required for async? If that question kind of makes sense, I'm sure there's a question in there somewhere
it
that
does.
I picked up.
I think the best way to answer it, and I'm afraid this is going to be a two-pronged answer, is that the model we want users to have in their head for how iterator and async methods work is different from how we actually implemented it under the hood of the compiler. And I want to give you a flavor of both.
Sure.
We had to introduce some actually new foundational concepts to the language. Let me tell you what they are. Mm-hmm. Normally, when you invoke a method, it runs the method through to the completion and then returns back to the caller. That no longer happens. So we had to introduce a new concept that we call a method instance. when you invoke a method, it creates a new instance of that method body. What does a method instance mean? Mm-hmm. A method instance is something that contains the local variables of that instance and contains the parameters of the instance and contains what we call a control point. That's the point of execution that it's in at the moment. An instance can just be sitting there. If one of these iterate or async methods has been suspended, the instance still exists with all of its local variables, with its execution point still somewhere inside the method, even though control has been transferred out somewhere else. Later on, control can return to that method instance and continue where it left off. This idea of method instances, it exists in other languages like Ada in some sense, but in modern languages without resumable methods, we haven't really needed it. Now that we've got them, we've had to introduce it. The question is, how did we implement this concept of instances? The way we did it is that when you invoke an async method, it just does a tiny little bit of work to create that instance. When it creates the instance, it's actually creating an instance of a state machine class. This is a class that the compiler synthesizes internally. The state machine class stores all of the local variables and the parameters, and it explicitly keeps the control point stored as an integer. It's just an integer to say which state in the state machine it's at. Later on, when you want to resume that method, that's achieved in the case of iterators by calling the moveNext method on the iterator. That invokes the moveNext method on the state machine, which looks at the current state, the integer, that tells it where it is. It jumps to that point in the code, and then it continues to execute. So, state machine classes are internally generated by the compiler. If you look in Reflect, you'll see what they're doing. And actually, if any of you programmed asynchrony before, you were writing these state machines by hand, and you know what I'm talking about. And you know how awkward it was. Mm. Really, we're doing all of that work under the hood by the compiler.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, let's talk a little bit about, we've talked in the talks that we've had so far with various people, we've focused mainly on task. Stephen Tobe, the interview we did, makes it explicitly clear why task makes sense. According to a lot of other machinery that came from that group, the stuff from Axum, stuff from the CCR. So
please mention F-sharp. F-sharp,
absolutely.
Shipped in Visual Studio 2010 with asynchronous workflows. We were inspired by that. Really, seeing that F-sharp could do it, they guided us, they showed us that it was possible, and they showed us that it was worth doing. The VB and C-sharp feature is an enormous debt to F-sharp.
Awesome. That's great to hear. So here it is, the newest language member of the family, the youngest child of the family, influencing the older children to evolve and grow. Beautiful. What about custom types? What if I want to make my own type and I want to make it awaitable? What does that mean? How do I do it?
Can you switch this video camera to the whiteboard?
Yes, I can.
I'm definitely going to need to write some stuff here.
Perfect.
Oh, actually, what's on the whiteboard at the moment is the Paxos Synod. I don't know if you've come across this. Paxos, it was invented by Leslie Lamport. It's the standard algorithm that all distributed systems use to... It's called leadership election, basically. If you have 10 different machines on the internet, they might have faulty connections between them, and somehow they need to communicate with each other to establish some consensus of what the answer is. Every single distributed system has this algorithm at its core. How is it implemented? Normally it's implemented by a great big state machine. And what my twin brother Damon was doing when he was teaching it to me was he was writing the parts of the state machine on the whiteboard.
Okay.
It's made of proposer, acceptor, listener, and they're all running through this state simultaneously. This is the start of a research project for us. Mm-hmm. We've already seen in some of the samples that were shipped in the async CTP, like the game example, that async means that you no longer have to write state machines explicitly, because that's all being done under the hood, like I told you, by this state machine class inside it. We're going to be able to write distributed algorithms, not writing explicit state machines, but using the async feature to write them in much more succinct ways. That's my belief, and we'll see if it pays out in the coming few months.
Excellent.
Anyway, I'm going to erase some of this to start answering your actual question.
So, of course, Leslie was on Channel 9. We had him on a while ago on an Expert to Expert with Eric, and we talked a little bit about...
Oh, that must have been colorful.
That was fun. Yeah, Leslie's contributions are pretty phenomenal.
So, let's see how we start. Let's start here. I've written a function f as task of integer. It's going to do a bit of work in here, and like many asynchronous methods, it's going to have an await statement in it. It's going to await some object. I haven't told you what it is. Let's suppose it's t. It could be any t, and we'll see how t fits into it later. It might be some task, and it will normally be some task, but you can also make it await your own types. I've got something. It's a task of integer, so it really should be returning an integer here. Return one. End function. Okay. What we said is that under the hood, this is being translated into a small stub and into a state machine. Let's write this state machine over here. Class F state machine. And it's going to have some stuff that I'm going to populate later. And the actual function itself, function F as task of integer, is merely going to create an instance of this state machine. Dim sm as new state machine. It's going to do a bit of work here that isn't yet important. It's going to create what we call a method builder. This is an internal type, sm.builder equals new. It's inside the system.runtime.compiler-services place. It's an async method builder of integer. It's going to kick off the state machine. In other words, it is immediately going to start executing the body, and then it's going to return sm.builder.task. So this is creating the method instance represented by the state machine. It's returning the placeholder, and it has started executing the preamble of the function. Basically, it started executing everything up to the first await statement. Let's see what happens with the await statement. This is the move next function, and its job is basically just to, whenever anyone calls it, it's going to execute the next available chunk of work. It might execute the first chunk of work up to the first await statement, or it might execute the next chunk of work up to the next await statement, or up to the end of the return statement. I'm going to show now how we translate this await statement itself. I'm going to switch to a different color. Await T we did. First, it's going to have a private field in here called T awaiter. In other words, this guy is going to be responsible for, it's going to manage the awaiting of T. Let's see how it works. First, we do T awaiter equals T dot get awaiter. waiter. This is one of the new functions. It's part of what we call the awaitable pattern. People might be familiar with patterns already. When you do for each over something, most of the time we do for each over an innumerable, but some people already know you can for each over any type you like. How do you do that? Well, any type you like, so long as it implements three functions. It has to implement get enumerator, and on that enumerator, it has to implement move next and current. If it implements those three things, you can for each over it. In exactly the same way, if there are three things that T implements, then we can await it. Get awaiter was the first one. Let's draw it in red. By the way, this method can be an instance method, and on task it is an instance method, or it can be an extension method, or it can be anything you like. Next. If T awaiter dot begin await of address of move next, then return. This is the next part of the dance. We call this begin await function. What that's going to do is it's going to ask the object T, have you already finished, or do you still have more work to do? T will probably be some kind of placeholder object, like I talked about at the beginning. Very often it will be task, and a task has a very good notion of whether it's already finished its work or if it's got more work to do. Or you can have your own meaning for your own types. Anyway, it says, if you have already... It says, if you have not yet finished, then we will return from this move next method immediately. In other words, our current chunk of work has nothing further to do if the task is not yet finished. Well, later on, when the task does finish, we've already told it the address of this move next delegate. So when the task has finished, it can invoke the move next delegate. That will be its responsibility once it's finished. It's going to invoke the move next method. It's going to come straight back here, and inside here, there's a go-to statement. It says, depending on which state I'm being left off in, I haven't written that, but it keeps that internal notion. Depending on which state I've been left off in, let's jump straight to the continuation point. Let's say it's down here. I've called it cont. What do we do at the continuation point? T awaiter dot end await. That's the magical third part of the await pattern. End await is what we can do to get the result of the long-running computation. Can you put the camera back up here? I suppose I should have made it a more complete example by writing dim x equals await t, because then it's very clearly dim x equals t awaiter dot end await. So if end await was a sub, you couldn't assign it to anything because it would be an expression
void.
To be void. But if it was something that returned a value, then that's what will go into x.
Nice.
Okay, this opens a whole load of possibilities.
Okay.
Let me tell you about some of the ones we've worked on so far. In one of the samples, actually, it's in the CTP, it's called the progress and cancellation sample. I wanted to write a code which does a bit of... it was the paddle game example. Now, what the paddle game did was it shows the UI and it says, about to play the game, click button to continue. I wanted to be able to write in my code, await button. You can't normally do that, but by implementing this pattern, I could. And I'll tell you how it worked. If we focus back on here, let's imagine I did await button. So instead of T, you have to think that T is a button.
Okay.
When I call get awaiter, it signs up an event handler for the button's click action. beginner weight always returns true. Later on, when the button click is fired, it will execute the move next delegate. So when the button is clicked, it will execute the move next delegate that will go through this method and it will end up here again. Mm. That was it. Let me tell you another example. I've been working with Eric Meyer and Wes Dyer on this. We wanted to think, what does it mean to await an eye observable?
Yes.
Now, I bet that you're going to do a Channel 9 interview with those folk, because this is a deep topic and there's definite conversation to be had there. What does it mean to await an eye observable? We had this debate. One person said, oh, when you await an eye observable, I'll just say, do you think everyone will know about eye observable already?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we've covered RX extensively on Channel 9.
Okay, good. So, when you await an eye observable, since an eye observable is a stream of events with a completion event at the end, one person said, when you await it, it should give you the first event that came back as soon as the first event came. Someone else said, when you await an eye observable, it should give you the last event that came, but only when the completed event fired. Another person said, when you await an eye observable, it should give you an array of all of the events that arrived, but only when the completed event fired. So we actually had very differing opinions on what should do. And that means, I think, that probably it's not appropriate to have a .NET or an RX canonical meaning for awaiting an eye observable. Instead, it feels like something that you might want to write yourself. Mm. Well, if T is an eye observable, then get a waiter is the guy who's going to create a subscription to that eye observable by providing the eye observer. Later on, when the eye observable completion event is fired, that's when the completion event can invoke the move next delegate and come up here with whatever results it decided to provide, the first, the last, the array.
Excellent. So, just to be clear, the stuff on the right side of the board here is what the compiler generates when it sees this code.
Absolutely.
And what we originally were talking about was, well, what if I want to create my own awaitable type?
Okay.
And you're saying this is exactly how
so
you do it.
The compiler has generated this for you. I haven't yet talked about how we're going to provide these three methods for our own awaitable type. And let's take an opportunity to do that.
Okay.
I'm going to write them over here. Three methods. I'm going to show you what the actual implementation is, more or less, for the task type, rather than stretching into eye observable or button click territory. I think the task type will be a good, solid introduction, and it will show you something else that I really want to communicate to authors of this.
Perfect.
Let's suppose that we're in the situation where some third party has provided the task of T type, and we're not allowed to modify it.
Okay.
The thing is that somehow, if I have T as a variable of type task of integer, say, when the compiler emits a call to task.getAwaiter, it needs to bind something. We face this problem when we ship the async CTP, you know, because the async CTP does not touch the .NET framework. It doesn't modify the existing task type. It instead adds all of this awaitable functionality onto it as extension methods. And that's the trick we're going to use. So we're going to have a module which has extension methods and an extension function getAwaiter of T, and its first parameter is self as task of T, and its return type will be a new type that I have to invent, which I'll call, let's say, task awaiter of T. And all it's going to do actually is return a new task, a waiter of tea with sort of tied to that particular task. I have two methods left. I'm wondering if they'll fit at the bottom of the board. I think they will, because this is quite a simple thing to do, actually.
Excellent.
So, we've implemented one of the three things, and that was the function getAwaiter, and it's implemented as an extension method on task. The next one we're going to do is in this class. Actually, let's make it a structure, because that's what we actually did. Why did we do it as a structure? Mm-hmm. Just because that avoids an unnecessary heap allocation.
Okay. So stack allocation.
Yeah. And I have a feeling that most people will probably want to be using structures at this point. It's going to have this method begin await function begin await, which will take a move next delegate as action, as Boolean. This is going to be the second of the three things we had to implement. What's it going to do? As I said, if the task is already completed, it will say, I haven't written the constructor. Let's just assume that the self-variable.
That's okay. That doesn't have to be particularly absolutely correct.
If self.isCompleted, then return false. Gee, people will have a hard time remembering, do I return true or false if it's already completed? I'll tell you the mnemonic I used to remember it once I get down to the next stage.
Okay.
So, if the task was already completed, we returned false, and that meant that in the original code, it would jump out of here straight to the end await call. In other words, it was using what we call the fast path, and we implemented that fast path for greater efficiency. Let's look at the slow path, where the task has not already completed. The first thing I'm going to do is say me.sc. It's a field, I haven't yet defined it, but we can assume it there, equals synchronization context dot current. This is a bit deep. The principle we have is that whenever the user does an await expression, the code that comes after the await expression should resume in the same context as where it left off. Especially in the case of a UI application, it should resume back on the UI thread. We need to have a mechanism for ensuring that we go back to the UI thread, and this is it. We save the current synchronization context. Then, self.continueWith. In other words, I'm going to tell the task self, once it's completed, it will continue with a certain action. What's it going to do? It's going to do S, after put a lambda here, and the lambda is going to do synchronization context dot post of the move next delegate. So, once the task is finished, it's going to ask the synchronization context to execute the move next function. I'm missing out a few bits here. When you type it in get compile errors, you'll know what they are, and it'll be obvious how to fix. And then we can return from this function straight away. I ran out of room.
Yep, but there's room there. Perfect.
Let's have the function end await. Function end await as, what will be its return type? Well, we were extending the type task of t. And when you await a task of t, we wanted you to get the t back at the end. So the return type is just going to be that t. I should say, just to notice, that here I've been using instance methods on my class task awaiter, mm-hmm. but here I used an extension method because task belonged to someone else and I couldn't change it. End await is going to be another one of these instance methods. So this is going to be the third component. What's it going to do? Well, this, we can safely assume that it will be called only after the task is finished, only after the move next delegate is executed, only after the move next delegate has got all the way to calling end await. Mm-hmm. The end await function is able to simply return self.result. That's not quite true.
Hmm.
Why isn't it true? It has to do with exceptions.
Ah.
In the task type, let's suppose that the task did have an exception. Mm-hmm. And that will be stored inside the task type. It will be stored within its exception.initException property. That's because task uses an aggregate exception to store all of the exceptions that might have been thrown inside it. We're only interested in getting one of them. So let's modify this code. If t.isFaulted, then throw t.exception.innerException. We're only actually throwing the first of the exceptions. That's because users need a very simple model when they do await t,
mm-hmm.
that they're only going to get a single exception out of it. They really do not want to get an aggregate exception out of it. That would screw up the try-catch handling in the code. So we threw away that part of task's functionality. We're only giving back the first exception that arises. The next problem.
Mm.
Tasks, if they're cancelled, normally we represent cancellation by a operation cancelled exception, but tasks do not store cancellation as an exception, meaning this would work. Instead, they store it in a special way. If t.isCancelled, then throw new operation cancelled exception. And only if neither of those two things happened, then we can return t.result. And that's it. That's, apart from error checking, that is actually what we have implemented.
Nice.
I want to draw attention to one particular thing, this synchronization context business. Synchronization context has existed for a while. Maybe readers are familiar with it because it provides a uniform way of talking about the current context, whether you're in WPF or in ASP or in WinForms. It's had kind of patchy support in the past because people didn't use it fully. Now we're using it very fully.
Mm.
When you write this code, when you write your own awaitable types, you're going to have to be very conscious of this. Sometimes synchronization context.current is nothing. Null if you're from C#.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? It means that probably the user was writing their code in a context where they don't care where continuations are executed. Mm. On a thread ball here or there. Maybe they deliberately set synchronization context to null to avoid incurring the cost of this synchronization context.post all of the time. Why would they do that? Maybe they were in a fast loop and they wanted to have lots of await statements, but it was all internal logic and they never needed to return back to the UI thread. They all just wanted it to be fast as possible with no extraneous sc.posts. So they will have deliberately used a technique to set the synchronization context null before calling a bunch of await statements, and in here you have to respect that. If the synchronization context was null, don't try to post to it. Instead, just execute the continuation, the move next delegate, wherever it happens to make most sense for you to do it efficiently.
Interesting. And that, of course, is an example of using async for performant computation, as opposed to, I don't want to lock the UI thread, or I don't want to block something in my application.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just an...
I'll give you a very concrete example of it. Maybe if you're using Visual Studio 2010, you're starting to write asynchronous code, you're finding it difficult, and you come to this stream.copyTo method. Maybe you wanted to copy one stream to another mm-hmm. stream. I ran into this. I was writing an ASP proxy. It wanted to just download something and send it on as the result, because that's mm-hmm. what a proxy does. I wanted to make it async. I wanted to call stream.copyTo async. I couldn't. That function wasn't in the framework. Why wasn't it in the framework? Because it was just too darn awful to write. It really was ugly to write. I mean, what should have been a very simple while loop, which just has a while loop, fetch the next buffer of data from one stream, write it to the next stream, continue until we're finished. Mm-hmm. You'd think that should take 6 or 7 lines of code. Actually, it mushroomed to 150 or 200 lines of code, and none of us were sure we'd coded it correctly.
Wow.
So that is a perfect case where I've just got it tight. Once we implement it with await, it's a heck of a lot easier.
Sure.
And while I'm inside this while loop, reading from one thing, writing to the other thing, there's absolutely no reason for me to be returning to the UI context all of the time. I might as well just do this mm-hmm. fast switch.
Excellent. And so I guess finally, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, when we started talking about, let's be honest, the many core thing, the parallelism, the general purpose supercomputing, all the stuff that's now in the face of general purpose developers. We're trying to make it easier to do parallel computation and now asynchronous computation. In this case, how comfortable are you that you've made it easy enough? So an example could be Rx, for example, very powerful, very beautiful in a theoretical sense, also in an empirical, real sense, yet does require, in some sense, that you have to up your conceptual understanding of what's really going on before you start writing code. Mm-hmm. What are you, in this case, let's be honest, you added two things, async and await. Task is a library thing. People are already aware of it. What are some of the pitfalls when you were designing this? How are you certain that this is the right approach? I mean, we can ask you that because we're at CTP. But how do you feel? Do you feel good that this is actually simple enough for...
I do, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to step back. I joined the company, Microsoft, 6.5 years ago. I was hired to work on concurrency type issues. I'd done my postdoctoral and my PhD research on this topic. I was really passionate about it. I joined a group called CCR that was doing concurrency. I remember very vividly, it was 4 years ago, we were doing a Bill Gates review. We sat there, we outlined our thing, and we said, this is awesome. Look, with our system, we've made it so performant that you can have 10,000 parallel things happening at the same time, and it just works. And he looked at us a bit flabbergasted. He said, what's the point of all this? Is this going to make Word run any faster? Is it going to make Outlook run any faster? The hard answer is that no, it's not. And we talk about parallel and multi-core and many-core, and people are running around like headless chickens thinking, help, 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 we have to deal with the multi-core world. Actually, that's not true. Actually, most user applications will not benefit from massive numbers of cores. If they're making a database application or a web application or a user interface application, they're spending their time blocked on the UI or the network or the database. They're not leveraging the CPU power. When will you leverage the CPU power? For the heavy number-crunching computational kernel of your code. That is the good time to use pre-existing libraries that someone else has written, like a video codec. That sure as anything should you leverage multi-cores. Mm-hmm. Or, if you've got an embarrassingly big link query, you should use parallel link to do it, and that will leverage multi-cores. But for the regular control structure of your programming, very little benefit, actually no benefit, to making it use all of the multi-cores. And it's easier if you don't use the multi-cores. The reason is that if you're just using this awake pattern in your main thing without creating background threads, you're running all on a single thread. You no longer need mutexes or semaphores or condition variables or critical sections. It makes the code a lot easier to write and a lot easier to get correct.
Now, I have to ask this, though. Now, in the world of software, in the world of any complex system, there's no such thing as no cost. Mm-hmm. So if, in fact, you aren't using other threads, and all of your computation can happen at different interleavings of time on your UI thread, doesn't that add some frailty to the system if something goes wrong?
It does add some cost. The cost it adds is the cost, basically, of doing this kind of synchronization context.post to the UI thread, mm-hmm. of the UI thread keeping a message queue of the delegates that it has to execute next. Mm-hmm. It also adds cost just to the data structure that we keep around. We're creating this state machine class with all of the variables, and that takes memory. Mm-hmm. The way I can answer this question best is by talking a bit about ASP. Mm-hmm. What is ASP? ASP is a web server. ASP means a high volume of requests comes in, 5,000 requests a second, let's say, and it has to deal with them quickly. Well, is it going to spawn a new thread to deal with each request? Or is it going to use this kind of asynchronous thing? They've both got their overheads. A thread has a lot of overhead. It reserves 1 megabyte of memory, and in .NET it commits that memory. It's got all of the context switching associated with it. This has the memory associated with the state machine. If you're doing this in ASP, or if you're doing any async programming in ASP, the bottleneck you're going to hit is that you might run out of memory first, whereas if you're just using a thread per thing, then you run out of threads first. As I said, each one takes 1 megabyte of memory, so there physically aren't that memory threads you can actually allocate, at least on a 32-bit system. The other thing, okay, we have threads. Windows, the operating system, gives us threads, but the threads it gives us are very well-tuned, and a lot of work has gone into the Windows tuning of its thread thing for large-weight chunks of work. It's not tuned for these small-weight chunks of work. We need a different thing that's tuned for small-weight chunks of work, and I think that's what async is.
Excellent.
How confident am I that we've got it right? Mm-hmm. You know, a week after the CTP goes out, I'm going back to talk, and I'll be delivering a talk to my old postdoc supervisor. It was all the concurrency research group there, and my PhD supervisor and the concurrency group there.
Awesome.
And I'll feel very proud to say, look, this is what we've done. We have finally solved the project that I set out at the start of my PhD thesis, and I'm very excited about that.
Awesome.
There's not going to be one single solution to concurrency, right? Never. Mm-hmm. For the theoretically minded audience, mm-hmm. They might think back to 1920 when the mathematician, was it Hilbert, I think, proved undecidability. He proved that there is not an effective decision procedure. There is not a computer program that can decide whether any given mathematical problem is true or false. Okay, that was a big shock to people then, and they thought there is no single solution to deciding whether maths is true, a maths statement is true or false. Does that mean that all of maths is pointless? No, it meant that all of maths had a giant, rich area and ecosystem for us to explore in. We have no proof that there'll be no single unified concurrency answer, mm-hmm. but I think the last 50 years of research has failed to come up with one, and I think it has led us fairly clearly to believe that there will not be a single concurrency, one solution that fits all problems. Mm-hmm. What we've got with async, it's not trying to solve everything. It's trying to solve the bits of the task that most users are writing most of the time. It's not going to help them leverage the multi-core well, but it will help them coordinate the bit of the code that uses the multi-core work. It will help them coordinate the bit that makes these other requests. And because most of the time most users are writing coordination or plumbing, it's going to hit that sweet spot very well.
Excellent. My other question I'd ask you, last one, is one of the benefits of .NET, regardless of the syntax you use to program the library, is the garbage collector.
Mm-hmm.
And with this new async model that you've created, there is nothing that was changed in the runtime. So there's no changes to the garbage collector, mm-hmm. no changes to the type system, right? You make changes to the language and the compiler of the languages. So what did you have, when you were spending a clearly an incredible amount of time thinking about these hard problems, how to make it easier for the rest of us, mm-hmm. Did you run into issues with garbage collection and objects being sort of, you know, disposed before they were ready because they weren't necessarily in the current context? So here's what I'm trying to ask you. How do you ensure that everything stays nicely in sync with the garbage collection
system? I think you're asking two questions. First, how do we stop garbage collection from happening too early? And second, how do we prevent it from happening too late?
Yes.
How do we stop it from happening too early? Well, let's suppose we've got this method. When we are executing the method, of course, things are on the stack. It's executing something. Everything that we reference from our execution point will not be garbage collected.
Sure.
Later on, we await a task T, and then we return to the caller. The question is, how do we make sure that the class machine, the state machine associated with this function is not collected? And the answer is, it comes down here. The statement self.continueWith of sub of sc.post of moveNextDelegate. This moveNextDelegate is a pointer to the moveNext function, and of course, being a delegate, it also points to an instance, and it points to the instance of the state machine. Therefore, so long as this moveNextDelegate is still in existence, as long as the task still thinks it's going to post the moveNextDelegate, the function will be safe from garbage collection. The next question you ask, and that's actually a very interesting one, is how do we make sure that garbage collection doesn't happen too late? And actually, surprisingly, the story here is no different from regular methods. When you have a regular method, everyone knows that the variables and the live references they hold in the regular method are kept live until that method exits. And some people, if they're really concerned about performance, are going to null out local variables just so the garbage collector can free them. Maybe you have a method which has some local variables, then it does a long piece of work that comes back. Maybe you want it to be garbage collected before that long piece of work happens, or during. That's why you'd null it out. In here we have exactly the same story. The local variables are going to have live references to them up until such time as the method exits. And if you want them to be garbage collectible earlier than that, then you'll null them out as well.
Excellent. Well, hey, I have to say, this is very impressive. And again, I mean, congratulations for adding iterators to VB.NET. And of course, this async pattern, I mean, it's beautiful, it's simple. I think people just have to download this stuff, play with it. If they haven't ever worked with Task, well, now they're going to. So they should spend some time, you know, playing around with that library. Yes?
Can I leave one closing thought?
Of course.
I don't know if that phrase is copyrighted by the...
closing thought?
Yeah. The closing thought is this. Async does not mean background thread. You're going to write a method, you're going to stick async on it, and sometimes you'll be scratching your head thinking, wait a minute, why isn't it running on a background thread? The answer you have to get very clear, async does not mean background thread. Actually, we added a warning to the compilers, VB and C#, to say, warning, you've written an async method that has no awaits in it. Do you realize that this method is going to run synchronously? If you want it to run asynchronously, consider putting the await operator in there to await for long I/O operations, or await for task.run if you want to do background thread. Mm. And this... just for a point of parity in VB and C# thing, there was tremendous cross-fertilization between the two languages. The async modifier was a VB feature that eventually C# adopted. This warning was a VB feature that we really got from feedback from the users that C# adopted. there are a whole bunch of other ones that C-sharp pushed into VB. It really went in both ways, and it's been a brilliant experience.
So you spent a lot of time with Anders.
Oh, yes.
Excellent, man. Well, hey, excellent work. Thanks for coming on Channel 9, and well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
So, thank you.
Congratulations on the Async CTP. Cheers.
Cheers.